Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report, finance presenter on ABC News and the columnist for The New Daily.
And I'm Stephen Main, contributor at Intelligent Investor, founder of Crikey, shareholder activist and City of Manningham councillor.
And we are The Money Cafe. Money Cafe, except we're not in the cafe because Greg's crook.
Thanks, Greg.
Our producer, but I was crook last week, so now it's his turn. Anyway, and you're not crook, Stephen. You sound like you're full of beans today.
Full of beans. Been up since 4 o'clock getting ready for this. Very excited, Alan. Let's go.
Oh, let's go.
Let's light some fires again.
Oh, that should be banned, that statement.
Yes, I know. Apologies to Bruce Lerman. Now, BHP takeover, what do you reckon?
It sounds like they're not going to get it at this price, but they seem to be determined, so they'll probably end up getting it, I guess. The problem is getting past the South African government because, it's pretty restrictive laws there, they can easily knock it back.
Well, I hope they do knock it back, Alan. I don't like this at all. They're paying too much. Anglo-American is the national champion of South Africa. Every country needs a good national champion. So I just think the politics is not great. I mean, and also, you know, BHP shareholders are not getting a vote on this, which is part of the very weak takeover laws in Australia. And BHP's got a history of overpaying. They overpaid for Billiton. They tried to pay $40 billion for the Canadian Potash Corporation, but that got knocked back as well. Also Rio Tinto overpaid for Alcan. Remember that? $44 billion. So there's a history of big miners overpaying, and this looks like one of those.
Righto. Well, fair enough. But, I think the strategy is right to expand into copper at this time. I think it's a perfectly reasonable idea for them to do this.
Well, I think they should make a big offer for the copper assets. I mean, they got out of Queensland Coal. Now they're going to be getting back into Queensland Metallurgical Coal with this deal. So there are other ways that you can get into copper without actually, you know, offering $60 billion in a very complicated multinational offer. I mean, remember when BHP tried to buy Rio Tinto for $140 billion just after the GFC? And they walked away from that. I ran for the board on a platform of this is a stupid deal and got 12.4% as a protest vehicle for the shareholders worrying that BHP was overbidding. And then the day they announced that they pulled out of the Rio bid, Rio shares fell by 40%, BHP shares rose by 15%, and BHP wrote off $450 million in transaction costs for a deal that didn't go ahead. These things are very expensive and complicated to try and undertake. BHP has a record of announcing and then failing.
I didn't know you got 12.4%. That's amazing. Christ.
Well, I got 17% from the UK shareholders, and they announced the deal was off on the day of the AGM, and shareholders were voting for me to send a protest vote because they didn't get a vote themselves on the actual takeover, which is one of the flaws in our corporate laws.
That must have been your high watermark, Stephen.
I've had $600 billion of votes against me, Alan, so I still had 87% against that day. But look, double figures from BHP was a feather in the cap, and thank you to all the shareholders who supported that tilt.
It was quite a feather in your cap there, Stephen, I reckon. Absolutely. Hey, now what's going on with the AGM season, mini season, as you call it, mini season?
Well, I mean, I think we should deal with Woodside last week, where Richard Goyder got a 16% against vote, but he got another 3 years, and there was a 58.5% vote against the climate action plan, which was a massive protest. And I wanted to throw in another statistic to you, Alan, that the turnout rate was only 58.5%. So the total votes cast was 1.112 billion. Out of 1.9 billion shares. So the 41.5% of the company that wasn't voted would have overwhelmingly been from the 620,000 retail shareholders. So we have an absolute crisis with retail shareholders not voting. And I was very disappointed that Woodside rejected my request to disclose the for and against voting in terms of shareholders and shares, because that would have highlighted what a tiny minority of the shareholders actually bothered to vote.
I suppose another way to look at it is that the institutions are voting and, they're making their views known.
Well, I must say that there's a massive disagreement on climate. So Woodside's appointed six new directors in the last few years, most of whom are international oil and gas types. So they are all in on hydrocarbons. They're not particularly, you know, they're not getting into any, you know, renewable stuff. And so the board is not listening, and the shareholders are saying, get serious with climate. But the shareholders are going to have to accept a lower share price if Woodside's not going to develop many of the new fields, which are, you know, from Scarborough down, which they're proposing to do. So at some point, the shareholders are going to have to say, we want a lower share price if we want Woodside to not proceed with all this big pipeline of projects and instead just leave them undeveloped.
Well, sure, but, you know, eventually fossil fuels aren't going to be used, so they're going to have to think of something else, surely.
Well, I don't know. I just think that, you know, you can't keep voting against the climate policy and voting for the directors when all the directors are all in global oil and gas players led by Richard Goyder, who's sort of the token local. So,
no, that's fair enough. I think you're right. Absolutely. Quite. I mean,
Meg O'Neill, they hired her from ExxonMobil. She's all in on, you know, maximum production, maximum profits. She is not for turning. She's the Margaret Thatcher of the oil industry. She's a tough woman. Oh, she's a tough executive. And if you want it, you know, Woodside to take a different approach on climate, you probably need to get a different CEO, not someone you've hired from Texas and ExxonMobil.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I think that's probably right. Yeah. Now, just moving on to interest rates, I don't know if you read my piece in yesterday's New Daily where I said that, noted that people are now talking about rate hikes this year instead of rate cuts. I mean, there's been a 180 degree burning rubber U-turn by the markets after last week's CPI, and everyone, and Warren Hogan on Friday, who's the Judo Bank consultant, he used to be ANZ's chief economist for a long time, he reckons there'll be three rate hikes this year. So I'm saying, listen, the Reserve Bank needs to ignore these people and stick to what it's been doing, which is to try to maximise employment and prevent and not have a recession because inflation has come down a long way, 7.8% to 3.6%, while unemployment has stayed well under 4%, and it's been going well. We've kept unemployment under 4%. We've got inflation down from 7.6% to 3.8%, and they need to hold the line, in my view.
But Alan, isn't full employment like 4%? So you've got an overheating labour market still. You've got ridiculous asset bubbles existing, most notably in housing. You've got serious service sector inflation not being snuffed out, if anything, getting worse, and that's being fed by the rising wages. The service providers have got to keep putting their prices up because wages are going up. And why are we at 4.35% when New Zealand, the UK and the US have all got official interest rates above 5%? Surely we need to go to 5% and fall in line with the rest of the Anglosphere, don't we?
As I showed in that piece, the Australian interest rates that people are actually paying have risen the most. So although the cash rate, the policy rate of the Reserve Bank has gone up less than all the other central banks, that's true, the interest rates that people are actually paying has gone up the most of all those countries that you mentioned. And the reason for that is because we've got variable rate mortgages and they've all got fixed rate, and we've got more debt and higher house prices. And so the Reserve Bank doesn't have to put up interest rates as much as the others because the impact is so much greater here. And yeah, we've got theoretically got full employment, theoretically got, a hot labour market, but that's not true, actually. Wages are not rising that much. So there isn't any, there isn't any need to cause unemployment to go to 4.5% or even higher. The Reserve Bank's view is that the rate of full employment is 4.5% unemployment. That's what it needs to get to. Well, I don't think that's true. And I think that they can leave it where it is. They don't need to throw more people out of work in order to get inflation down. Inflation's coming down. It's fine.
But I think globally, inflation's not coming down as fast as people were hoping. And that's the story in Australia too, particularly on service sector. Well,
it jumps around all the time. I mean, inflation surprised on the downside in December quarter. It surprised by the same amount upside in the March quarter. And let's see what happens in June. I reckon it's all over the place.
Well, I do agree we should wait for another quarter of CPI, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if we get the first of potentially a couple of rate rises, because I just, you know, the Aussie dollar is still weak at 65 cents. That's partly because our official rates are lower than most of the rest of the world. I just struggle to see how we're out of whack with the rest of the world when our economy is still booming and we've still got inflation. I mean, we haven't had that soft landing yet.
No, but the point is we're not out of whack. I mean, yes, the policy rate's out of whack, but the actual interest rates that people are paying is not.
Yeah, and we do have the most indebted households in the world. So it does hurt balance sheets of those with mortgages a lot more than any other country. So
that's exactly the point. So we don't. Our interest. You've got to take a more subtle view of it. It isn't just about the central bank policy rate.
Yeah, that's a fair call. But I still think they're going to go up, and I'm glad the Reserve Bank kept their options open when everyone was pressuring them to promise they'd be cutting aggressively. And it's got to be data-driven. Inflation's the number one indicator, and it's a bit of a worry. It's a bit of a worry, Alan.
So here's my prediction for you, Stephen. We can revisit this in, a year's time or 2 years' time. I reckon when we are doing the Money Cafe this time next year, the interest rate, cash rate will not have changed. And when we're doing Money Cafe in 2026, which we'll still be doing in April 2026, 2 years away from now.
When you're 74.
When I'm 74, the cash rate will still be where it is now. It won't change.
I'll give you $500 in 2 years' time if interest rates have not changed over the next 2 years. And you can give me $100 if they have.
You're on.
Done.
Okay, there you go. So, everybody, you're a witness to this. S. Maynard.
And I don't believe in gambling, of course, Alan. So,
no, you do not. Now, yes, anyway. So, will you just quickly have us say something about Elon Musk? Go on.
Yes. Well, look, you see, Tesla shares were up 15% overnight.
Yeah, why is that? What happened?
Oh, look, the Chinese government are going to let they've done a deal with Baidu, the big internet behemoth in China, and the Chinese government's going to let Elon do his driverless vehicles in China. So he's visiting China for a visit, so the market's gone berserk about Chinese upside for Tesla, which makes the point that shareholders in Tesla should vote against the proposed pay deal for Elon at the June 13 shareholders meeting coming up, including the Future Fund, which owns more than $117 million worth of Tesla shares. So if Albo and everyone else is so upset about, you know, Twitter not taking down those videos and things like that, vote your 117 million Future Fund shares against the outrageous Tesla share proposal for Elon Musk, where he will be given 23 million shares he'll be given 304 million shares at $23, which will cost him $7 billion only, when they are currently worth $59 billion. Why would you vote to give someone $59 billion worth of shares when they only have to pay $7 billion US dollars for it? Vote against, and you don't get $52 billion US dollars of dilution based on the current price. And greedy Elon currently owns $79 billion US dollars worth of shares. He does not need to get all these new shares to have any incentive. So vote against on June 13, Alan.
Excellent. I will.
Good.
I'll vote my zero Tesla shares against it.
Because you do know they've got the most shareholders of any American company. They've got over a million shareholders. So everyone, you know.
I did not know that. Is that right? There you go.
Yeah. Well, the Australian chair, Robin Delholm, she gloats about that in her cover letter. Because remember, the judge voted down this pay deal. So the board have just rolled over and said, let's put it up again after the judge in Delaware voted it down. They're moving the company from Delaware to Texas as a protest against the judge. And Robin Delholm has done this rah-rah political pitch about How dare this judge overturn your democratic view? Come on, shareholders. Poor old Elon hasn't been paid for the last 6 years. Let's pay more. You know, it's just ridiculous, the rah-rah. And she's going for the retail shareholders because they've got so many retail shareholders, well over a million.
Well, there you go.
But the Future Fund is going to vote their 396,000 shares against if Albo just gives them a call and says, I know I'm not allowed to interfere, but I hate Elon, so can you please vote those shares against his pay rise? Thank you, Future Fund.
Yes, we should all make our views known to Albo. And the new chair of the Future Fund, I'm not sure he's taken over yet, Greg Combe.
Greg Combe, indeed.
I don't know.
But the Future Fund is entirely independent of the government, and it's illegal for them to be directed how to vote their shares, let alone how to invest.
Well, it won't be independent of Greg Combe.
No. So Combe can just make sure those votes go against Elon and save the Tesla shareholders all that dilution. We should do some questions, Alan. We've only got 28 this week.
I know, well, we're not going to get through them all, so we'll better get going with it. Before we do, let's have a quick word from our sponsor.
InvestSmart's portfolios are turning 10. To celebrate, 10 InvestSmart boot camps are up for grabs. This self-paced online course is ideal for both seasoned investors and those just starting out. Valued at $99, you could win a spot on this highly rated course. To enter the competition and for terms and conditions, simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Don't miss out on this chance to learn from the experts and take your investing to the next level. Visit investsmart.com.au/win. Good luck.
Okay, 28 questions. We're not going to, we'll see if we can get through as many as we can. Number one's from Kate, who appears to be our only female. Is that right?
Correct. Unless Chris times three or Sam is female. Kate is our only female questioner, so she gets to go first. And Kate says that she's a single woman with no recourse to family financial support. I've got a good super balance, save over half my income. I've been actively looking to buy a home, but I can only afford a flat. But your advice is to don't buy flats, buy a house. And so she's saying, should I buy a flat at all or should I just rent forever? And thanks for your advice. And my comment is, let's call them apartments to start with. Let's not talk down apartments and call them flats. And look, I always strongly support buying your own principal place of residence. Lots of flats, lots of apartments are good investments. So, Kate, absolutely keep saving, buy yourself a nice apartment and treat it as a principal place of residence and a place of shelter as opposed to having an investment strategy to your home.
And property strategists always say it's best to buy old apartments in small blocks if you can, well-made ones. One of the problems with buying apartments is the new ones tend to be poorly made, or a lot of them are anyway. So possibly best not to buy off the plan. I mean, that's not an ironclad rule. There are some off-the-plan flats that are fine, or apartments, I mean, that are fine. But, yeah, look, try to stick with old ones is what the property people say.
I would agree with that.
George says, love the podcast. Like others in their 20s, I purchased primary residence years ago, now have equity. So looking at investment options, the classic option would be to buy an investment property with a loan secured to the home. However, the returns aren't great once deducting transaction cost, maintenance, headaches with agents, etc. When you compare the returns of low-fee ETFs with dividend reinvestment, the return outperforms city-based property. However, leverage is the reason future dollar value is higher. What are your thoughts on using the investment loan to purchase ETFs with a time frame of 20-plus years instead of property? What do you reckon, Stephen?
Well, I mean, George's point is right that we all happily gear into property, but, you know, we don't tend to encourage people to take out big margin loans to buy shares or to buy ETFs or those sort of things. I think you've just got to look at your balance sheet overall and not have too much leverage across all of your investments, property, shares, ETFs, super, you know, whatever it is. I mean, I would also, you know, encourage looking at turbocharging your super contributions, particularly if you're paying plenty of tax at the moment. But look, yeah, a small amount of leverage into some ETFs, sure, but if we get some more rate rises, which as we were discussing earlier, Alan, if we do get some more rate rises, I'm actually worried that we'll get some, you know, 10-15% drops in asset prices. So I wouldn't be sort of leaping right now into a geared ETF investment.
Yeah, and also, George, just keep in mind the opportunity cost of not reducing your mortgage further, which, you know, you need to just look at the pre-tax cost of that. Yeah, I mean, this money that you're using to invest in is not free. Obviously, it comes with a cost. It's not just the gearing, it's the cost of the money as well. So it means your starting point is whatever it is that you're paying for the money. Yeah.
Now, Paul has submitted a comment basically bagging work from home, saying it's not been good for his marriage and his wife is unable to, quote, leave it at work, particularly given the home office is right next to the kitchen where he's wrangling school lunches and dinner prep. He also makes an interesting point, and he's disputing the 67 cents per hour tax rebate that work from home people are allowed to claim without any receipts. And he's saying that the internet, Wi-Fi, water for toilets, electricity, heating, cooling, appliances, office hardware, consumables all comes to much more than 67 cents an hour, and the government is ripping us off. And I have to say, I agree, Paul. That is ridiculously low. 67 cents per hour is the no receipts claim, and so maybe your better option is just to keep all your receipts and claim the specifics of the work from home costs.
Yeah, I agree totally. Keep the receipts, and think about what percentage of the house is being employed for working from home, because it's not simply the office. It's other parts of the house as well. Rob says, Stephen, are you the only activist shareholder out there? It doesn't seem that there are any others out there doing what you do. Do you have an ultimate goal that you're trying to achieve, or are you just trying to keep them honest? These are good questions, Stephen. I'm interested in your answer to this.
Look, I did once work out, Alan, that there were 1,300 paid union officials in Australia a few years ago, if you added them all up, and I was sitting there going, so there's 1,300 professionals helping the workers of Australia, and there's not too many shareholder advocates or activists trying to help the 7 million shareholders. But, look, the Australian Shareholders Association does a great job with covering the ASX 200, getting to around 200 AGMs a year. I always encourage people to join them and give their proxies to them. They had 1,000 shareholders give them Woodside proxies last week and vote more than $5 billion worth of stock a year in undirected proxies. My biggest disappointment is the lack of debate at AGM. So I just try to go along and underwrite the debate of the AGM so it's not a meaningless event. I really would love to see the big industry funds turning up at AGMs and making it more interesting. I love it when the old Peter Morgan at Perpetual and more recently Fred Woollard is a fund manager who recently went to the AMP AGM. David Kingston is a rich list guy who's been a revelation recently, asking questions at Centre Group, Star, Redcape, VGI, Ardent Leisure, a whole bunch of companies. So I'm just trying to help create a culture of shareholder pressure and making sure there's some debate at AGMs, because it absolutely matters who is on the boards of these companies when the government forces every Australian to be exposed to the share market via compulsory super. And then the average director gets 96% in favour, and I just think it's, you know, there's not enough of a culture of accountability. Too often there's AGMs with no debate. I mean, last week I went to Latitude, you know, financial services AGM. I turned up in the city because it was a physical AGM where online questions were banned. I was the only person who asked questions over about an hour, and if I hadn't turned up, there'd have been no debate at all. And that is just a wasted opportunity in terms of having a proper debate. These are public companies and there should be public debate at the AGM. Alan, when are you going to turn up at your first AGM, Alan, and start asking some questions yourself?
Now you're putting it on me, crikey.
You've never done one, have you?
No, I have not. Absolutely have not, no. No. I'm busy kind of holding them to account in my columns and all that stuff. So
I got into it because basically it was a way where you could be legally protected and they couldn't tell you to shut up or tell you something was off the record. So particularly the billionaires like the Murdochs, the Packers and the Lowys and the Kerry Stokes and Solly Lewis of the world, they'll never answer my questions if I email them through or approach their spin doctor, but they have to legally at the AGM. So I've got, you know, tiny holdings in 300 companies and you've been to 800 AGMs. I'm doing 100 a year. I love the online. You just cut and paste your questions and they read them out for you. So, look, it's a good way to be a journalist because the law protects you and gives you the access to these people. And I'd love to do it globally and set up the International Shareholders Association one day, because there is no such thing. There's not even an American Shareholders Association, would you believe?
Is that right?
Yeah. So someone should go to America, sit in the same building, set up the American Shareholders Association and the International Shareholders Association, and then run a big campaign to get retail shareholders to vote against Elon Musk's Tesla pay heist on June 13 at the AGM. Instead, there's no organised opposition to it, which is very disappointing.
Well, good for you, Stephen.
Now, Miles says, my wife and I are circling early retirement and get tremendous enjoyment from you blokes. To the question, I'm having a gap year before my retirement starts next financial year, so I'd like to cash in any capital gains this financial year to be taxed in a lower at a lower rate. The obvious method is to sell and then repurchase my holdings that are above water. But is there some magic trick that lets me declare the capital current capital gain as income and reset the cost base to the current value without having to pay two rounds of brokerage? Well, look, no. I got in trouble previously talking about it being legal to do tax loss washing, which is not. So you can't just sell shares and buy them back and claim a tax loss. So I would just suggest that you pay the brokerage, crystallize some gains before June 30, do it legitimately, and then just buy back in when the market corrects in the new financial year. Just keep it simple. Don't try and do anything too fancy, and sell some of your profitable shares while you're in a low tax year this year.
And don't use an expensive broker.
Yeah. I mean, CommSec is, I'm buying all these shares at the moment for AGMs. It's 10 bucks. You know, it's nothing. It's really cheap. So don't not do things because of brokerage. With stamp duty on property, it is different because that can be as high as 5% in Victoria. So that is a transaction you do want to avoid, stamp duty on property. But brokerage on shares, it has been competed away with the online brokers, and it should not be an obstacle to trading your investments.
There you go.
Now, Ian says, this is one for me, in light of Alan's 72nd birthday on April 26, could you please provide us with an update on your replaced knee?
No, it's just, he says knee or knees, and the answer is it's just one knee. I'm never going to get the other one replaced no matter what happens. The joint is good. The new metal joint is fine, except that it makes it such a bloody nuisance traveling on planes because it sets the it sets the metal detector off, and I've got to bloody take everything off and take my belt and shoes off, and oh god, it takes ages to get through security. But there was a problem with the nerves in the knee. They seem to have been stuffed up in some way during the operation, and they 3 years later they continue to hurt. Which I've done stuff. I went to a pain specialist. That didn't work either. So anyway, I just have to put up with it.
It sounds bad enough, Alan, that you definitely deserve your disability special car park voucher. Every time I bump into you, you seem to be getting the best car park in the street because of this dodgy knee of yours.
Well, the doctor and the local council very kindly gave me one of those car parking form things, which I carry in the car at all times. And that's great. It really is. Makes it all worthwhile.
Well, it sounds like it's justified. Thank you, Boroondara Council. All right, Alan, your turn.
Patrick says, I'm in my final subject of my MBA through Griffith University in Queensland, and throughout the course we have a distinct sustainability focus within business leadership. I'm interested to see if your experience in industry analysis has seen any paradigm shift towards meaningful, focused outcomes, e.g. social return on investment impact reporting and genuine ESG reporting, or are Australian businesses still focused on profitability as its main metric for success? Oh, yes, I think they are focused on profitability as the main metric, but there's definitely a much greater focus on ESG, no doubt about it. There's a lot of pressure on companies to do that. They're all doing it, you know, all having ESG reports and, you know, talking about it. Some of it's more meaningful than others, let's face it, though. And a lot of companies are seeing the writing on the wall and are understanding that the world is in an energy transition and they need to be involved. Otherwise, they'll get left behind. So it's both a matter of appearing to be concerned about ESG, but also making sure that you get on board what's happening.
Look, I agree. That Woodside climate vote was a very good example of an ESG vote. I think ESG has never been bigger, but I mean, I was on a panel at the Sorrento Writers Festival on Sunday, and all sorts of heavies were in the audience. I think Lee Clifford was one of the sponsors, the former Rio CEO and Qantas chair. So, and I did say on this panel that the actual trading of a share price is a major problem because you're judged and valued every single day. And if you're a public company, it's very hard not to think about the share price. And as soon as you announce you're doing something, you know, sensible or responsible, like if a big casino company suddenly said, we're getting rid of cash, we're not doing any VIP high rollers, we're not giving free drinks, you know, all those things they were doing for years until the various scandals came up, the share price would have halved if they'd actually done the ESG thing and been a really responsible gambling company. So, and also the remuneration has moved a little bit, so it's not just totally on the profit. I love the fact that if there's a fatality at a mining company, you will see the CEO's short-term bonus getting seriously clipped. So those sort of things have moved, but it is still the overwhelming driver of corporate performance and activity is the holy dollar.
I think we should skip a few. We're running out of time. Skip a few questions. Go down to Ryan.
All right, you take it away.
Ryan, with the current talk about inflation and consumer spending being strong and not declining as expected, how is foreign tourism accounted for in the calculation? For example, I was at a brewery in Perth on Wednesday and the place was pumping, but most accents I heard were British or American. Well, there you are. No, it's not measured. Tourism, I think, is, you know, not a particularly big factor in inflation. I think probably immigration might be. It certainly increases demand. Anyway, what do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, look, I think tourism is important. It's not separately measured, but far more important to the economy these days is the international students, which they've absolutely rocketed. I mean, I was stunned when I was a City of Melbourne councillor to be told that 42% of the residents in the City of Melbourne were students and that Melbourne was one of the four biggest international student cities in the world, along with Paris, London and New York. So it is a huge driver of our economy, provides a lot of labour. I remember seeing the statistic as well that Melbourne had more female tourists than male tourists. And you know what we worked out that was? That was mothers visiting their children who were international students in Melbourne. So, I think that the student side of things is a far bigger factor in the economy, and there is a bit of a backlash with housing prices and those sort of things. But, Australia is one of the great education countries and we're making a lot of money from it. It's very important for our economy.
Yes. Okay, yours.
Now, Adam says, the Financial Review dedicates four pages to rows and rows of numbers which are obsolete by the time they are read. The ABC Finance Report does less of this but still includes some better figures. And he's basically going on saying, why are we still printing share prices in the newspaper? It's probably one for James, but, what are we going to do next, Alan? Kill off the racing form guide? I still like looking at the printed list of the top 150 companies by market cap in the Weekend Australian, but, you don't look at the printed share prices anymore, do you, in the Fin Review?
It's been a few years since I've bought any kind of printed newspaper, and I'm amazed that the Financial Review still runs all these share prices in the paper. Like, is that right? Do they do that still?
Well, look, I think you'll find, Alan, the demographic of people getting printed newspapers is very, very old. I know that they have scripts when people ring up to cancel where, you know, oftentimes a large proportion of the cancellations are from the passing of someone, the death of a long-term subscriber. So I think they're just catering to the non-internet readership and it will disappear in time. But as long as you're printing it, you may as well print the share prices because what else are you going to put in the Fin Review?
But that's still a cost. I mean, that's, cost money to and paper and ink and all that. Crikey. I mean, I think you'd want to know that people were actually looking at it. Crikey.
Yeah, you probably should research it, but I'm guessing they might get paid for it. But, it's a fair point. Now, I want to get to Stephen's question. He says, noting the existence of property and suburbs restricted to older people, e.g. 55+, is it time that we have certain locations or properties that are restricted to those aged 20 to 35 instead? The idea would be that subsidised living by the government is provided for younger folk while they try to build up their own deposit to purchase when they are 35 plus. Gee whiz. Well, I mean, I will point out to Stephen that there is a lot of student housing, like the likes of Scape, which is a big UK student housing provider, where it's only for students. So there already is housing, which is just for students, just like there are retirement villages which are targeted at the over 55s. I don't think the government should be coming in and designating suburbs or particular developments for people of a particular age bracket. What do you reckon, Alan?
Yeah, I agree. Sure. I mean, I don't think we can do that. time for a couple more questions, I think. Tom says, thanks for a great podcast. Quarterly essay was good too. I've been ready for the sequel, The Path Towards Solutions. There's solutions in it, Tom. Really enjoyed my question being read out a couple of years ago. Right. I played it to my wife many times. Are there any green renewable companies to watch on the ASX? GenX seems to be about to be bought out. AGL is a way to go. Hydrogen was all talk, but the only company I can find seems to be Hazer HZR. Are there any other ways to get behind the energy transition? There's not many. There's another company called Pure Hydrogen, which is building building a hydrogen factory in Brisbane, and also has just launched or is about to launch on Thursday. In fact, is going to launch in Dandenong on Thursday a hydrogen-powered garbage truck made in Australia, which I think is very interesting. So that might be worth a look. But there aren't many, that's for sure.
It is sad. And like GenX has been painful. It's being taken over by a big Japanese player now. You're right, Tritium did go broke, partly because I think the EV, electric vehicle take-up rate, has been slower than expected. So, look, yeah, apart from lithium and on the mining critical minerals side, the energy transition, you know, it's the old story of Australia. We always seem to struggle with anything a bit value-add or down the chain, but you just go back to dig it out of the ground as the core business. But, look, it's very disappointing that there aren't more genuine energy transition companies amongst the remaining 2,100 listed companies as the ASX continues to shrink. And I think we should finish up with Chris, who has a similar question about wanting to invest in infrastructure and pointing out that Hostplus no longer provides retail members an opportunity to invest in their IFM infrastructure fund, and that infrastructure ETFs are for listed assets only. And the fear that Chris has is that a lot of the best assets are sitting there in the private markets, and how does he get access to them? And it's a good point. I mean, we lost Sydney Airport, $25, $30 billion takeover in 2021, I think it was. Transurban obviously is the best toll road company in the world and the biggest. But after that, you've got what? The Dalrymple Bay Infrastructure Terminal, the coal export terminal up there in Queensland, although that's not very ESG friendly. So, look, I do agree that, like with energy transition, there are not enough really good listed infrastructure assets left. Many of them got snapped up by the Canadians. Many of them been snapped up by the Macquaries of the world and the industry funds. So, look, yeah, it's a bit thin, surprisingly.
Yeah, that's true. Very thin. I mean, there's Atlas Arteria is a toll road company too, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, their AGM's coming up. Actually, you're right. Their biggest investment is one in toll road in France. They got spun out of Macquarie a few years ago. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, IFM is trying to buy them, or has been. They've bought more than 20%, and they want to take that one private too, just like they did with Sydney Airport. So, but you're right. There are two listed toll road outfits you can get access to as a retail shareholder.
Well, that's it for today. Thanks very much for listening, everybody, to today's episode of Money Cafe. I'll be back next week with James Thompson. Send in your question. We'll try to answer it. Keep it short and send it into themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au. Until then, I'm Alan Kohler, writer for Intelligent Investor and as also The New Daily.
And I'm Stephen Mayne, also a writer for Intelligent Investor.
See you next week.